Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, fishing for rights. Urging nations to adopt an international convention protecting the work and rights of fishermen, where the Vatican stands on the issue. And, even when times are bad, how can we help others help themselves? Our supermarket cart or grocery basket may provide the answer. Open seas for days and sometimes weeks or even months at a time, with shoddy living conditions, little time to rest, spoiled food to eat, and sometimes mistreatment by the ship's crew or captain. That's sometimes the sort of millions of men and women who make a living from fishing. More fishers die on the job than workers in almost any other profession. And sometimes, instead of receiving a just wage, they're given a share of the value of the fish they help catch. Until now, no international legislation has protected the working conditions of the world's fishers. But now, under the UN umbrella, 437 countries in June 2007 overwhelmingly agreed to a new convention for fishermen. But not one nation has yet ratified it. And that, says the Vatican office responsible for the apostleship of the sea, must change.
Regarding both maritime transport and fishing, the ILO adopted some important conventions in 2006 and 2007 that represent a great opportunity for the maritime world. Now the apostleship of the sea needs to carry out a task of advocacy around the world so that these conventions will be ratified and have force of law as soon as possible.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is secretary of the Pontifical Council for Migrants.
For the first time in the world history, it is feared that fish will disappear from the seas. Since more than a billion people depend on fishing for their food needs, and an estimated 41 million people work directly in this activity. The exhaustion of fish resources represents, therefore, a very great danger for all these people. Entire communities of fishers are threatened with extinction. The workers of the sea tend to work and act individually. This is why their voice is rarely heard on the national or international level. It is also AM's duty to be the voice of the voiceless by helping them to become aware of the situation they are living and the deadlines they will have to face. It is also a duty to always be close and have solidarity with all the living forces working in this sector for the good and dignity of man.
Ted Richardson is one of those who's calling for the ratification of the new Convention for the Good and Dignity of Fishermen. He's regional director of the Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania. I asked him why no one has signed this important protocol.
I struggle to understand the rationale in things like the ILO.
Which is the International Labour Organization.
Yeah, which will sit down and thrash out a fundamental right of every person to care for what they need, what their minimum standards of working and conditions and environment that they work in it should be like. and all the countries will say, this is great, we have a document here that we can call Convention 188. And then they make recommendations for minimum standards of wages, food, these sorts of things for people. And they put a recommendation to it. And then it gets put on a shelf. 2 years later, we get this recommendation and this convention coming out to us, and it says, well, how many nations have ratified? Since they all agreed to it, how many nations have ratified? None. Not a one.
So all these nations, though, are involved in the production of this convention.
Yeah.
However, none of them wants to sign up to it.
No. It's just because they say, well, we've done our work.
Our conscience is clear.
Mm-hmm. We've said what the minimum standards are here. Who's going to be the first one to ratify it? And they all sit back and wait for somebody else to be first.
The first one.
And everyone says, well, we've got better standards than this in that country anyway, so why bother ratifying it? The point of ratifying is that it makes it law that people can't abuse somebody else's labour. That if a ship came to my country and we've ratified this, we have the power to say, hang on, we've got you. We can fine you under our law because we've ratified this ILO convention. So we can actually seize your vessel, we can take your stock, we can charge you with breaking the law. But at the moment we say, it's none of our business, you know, you can have a 10-year-old child working on a fishing vessel and nothing we can do about it.
But presumably many of these countries, as you say, have their own individual legislation that guarantees that a 10-year-old child is not working.
Yeah.
On a sea vessel.
And we have it in Australia. We have minimum standards for Australians working on these ships. The National Director of India was telling me that their minimum level of somebody working on a ship is 18 years of age. But if another ship came in with a child of 10 or 8, nothing they can do because they've not ratified this. So they can't say, sorry, you can't have that person working on that ship. It is illegal to have that person working on that ship. And until you employ people at the right age, we won't let your vessel go.
So explain this to me a little bit better. A ship comes in from Southeast Asia or something into an Australian port. It has a 10-year-old child working on board. Mm. The Australian port authorities are not allowed to do anything about it?
No. It's under a different country's rules and regulations.
But it's on Australian territory.
Yeah, but we've not ratified the convention, so we have no power to inspect it. Our maritime safety authorities cannot go on board the ship and look at the food conditions or look at the sleeping conditions on board the ship or the minimum age of the employees on the ship or how they're paid or how they're sustained. They have no authority to do anything other than say, is your ship seaworthy? Will it sink in our waters? If it won't sink in our waters, then off you go again.
So why aren't countries signing up for this?
I struggle to understand why.
They just don't want to be bothered. It's an extra police and security cost.
Yeah. They write the legislation for the ILO, and then it goes into a shelf, and it sits there. And the guys in the ILO struggle themselves to get these things out into the public. They come to us in the Pontifical Council meetings and said, we need to ask your help to get this to your governments so that your governments can understand from you that this is needed, because they're not listening to us. We're just the ILO. We might have a nice big logo and a nice big place that we all come to meet, but unless you do it in your country, it's not going to happen. We can scream and yell, but they're not going to listen to us. They'll only listen to you and your people because you're the voters. You're the ones that put the governments in power, and you're the ones that can take them out. And we can't do anything but ask them, please, can you ratify this? So we need to rattle cages in our governments. And every nation needs to look at these conventions and resolutions and say, adopt them. They're not so hard. You've already agreed to them. You've already had them on the table. You've read them all and you've said, yes, we agree to them. Adopt them. Make them work.
And what are some of the things that are contained in this convention?
The main things are minimum age.
It's called, actually, I see the brochure here, it's called Decent Working Conditions, Safety and Social Protection, Working in Fishing Convention.
Yeah. That is basically exactly what it says. It's the working conditions. what hours that people are made to work. They can't work people for 22 hours a day. They have a minimum food requirement and safe food, that they're not eating spoilt food, that young people are not brought into the industry below a certain age, that they have an education, that they are trained and educated in the work that they're undertaking, that they have the ability to be able to go ashore, to spend time, to make sure their families are fairly compensated for that person's employment. Then that person gets compensated well for their employment as well. These are just the minimum standards that we should have, that we expect in our jobs. In the first world, that we look for a job, we know when we go for an interview for a job that we're going to have a certain amount of hours that we're going to be working for, that we will have a morning tea and a lunch, that we will have a time that we will knock off and go home, that we'll have a weekend, or we're paid overtime, or
health insurance, retirement, all
yeah,
that sort of thing.
Superannuation, and whether you're compensated if you're injured at work.
Mm. But what about these? But isn't this quite onerous for many governments if they have to start policing or investigating to see whether even, you know, small family-run businesses, fishing vessels and so on, who might have one or two or three or four people working together, isn't that maybe perhaps one of the reasons why governments haven't signed up to this? Because it's quite an onerous thing.
In some ways you could say yes, but if you're looking at a family business, then a family work at making it better for the family. They work at looking after each other. They care about each other. They're not going to work one of their family into the ground to say, you know, you keep slaving away so that, you know, I can have some time off or I can go on a holiday. So a family business is probably a good analogy for governments to look at to say, would I look after my children this way? Would I treat my kids this way? Let's make sure that if you need a doctor, we make sure we get you to a doctor. You need good food, let's make sure I get you good food. Not feed you poorly, not treat you poorly.
Do you ever get in this work that you do jaded? Do you ever feel, I'm fighting for the rights of these people and nothing's happening?
It becomes frustrating at times when you feel like often you're just a voice in the wilderness, you know, crying out, say, come on, do something. You get annoyed. And then all of a sudden you get a seafarer comes up to you and he'll say, thank you. And it'll just be, thank you for what? I didn't do anything. You did a lot for me. You spoke for me. You talked for us as fishers. You talked for us as seafarers. We heard you on the radio or we read something about you in the newspaper, and you have nothing to gain by talking for us, and you talk for us. And just to get one person to say thank you just builds you up to say, I can fight harder, I can work harder, I can do more. Because you know you've made an effect on somebody. Maybe somebody you've never met, somebody you will never ever see, but you know that in your heart you've made something better for somebody else somewhere else. And that's the important thing that we should all have in our life, that whether you're a radio presenter here in the Vatican and you don't see a seafarer ever in your life, you know that through this media, you have touched a seafarer. You have touched somebody. You've made their life better. And in doing that, you've improved the world. You've made it better for seafarers. The listeners that listen to the broadcast will go and talk to somebody else, will talk to a family member and say, I heard this. I now know what this is about. And I can do something. So in every way, you do something, you improve it. So that builds you up as a person. You say, we can make a difference, whether we're one or whether we're many. We can make a difference, and we do.
Ted Richardson is Regional Director of the Apostleship of the Sea for Oceania. From coffee, tea, chocolate, and rice, to candles, gifts, and clothing. They're the kind of products offered by stores and organizations part of the Fair Trade Movement, a global push to give farmers and local producers their fair share of the prices of the items we buy.
More and more fair trade conscious shops have popped up in big cities and towns across the globe. But still, fair trade has not become a common household term. Well, I sat down with the Justice and Peace Promoters for the Dominican Order, Sister Toni Harris, and for the Marist Fathers, Father Paul Frechet, to talk about why fair trade should matter to any of us. But first, I asked Sister Toni how she explains fair trade to those curious to know more about it.
Fair trade is a term that's become fairly more well-known, I think, since the late 80s. And it describes an effort to assure that the people who produce goods are given a fair price for their goods and some kind of a stable price for their goods. For example, people who produce coffee are often victims of the market that can be controlled by forces far removed from their countries. But fair trade organizations and fair trade systems have tried to create connections between local producers and ways of distributing their products so that they are not the ones who in the cycle of distribution are the people who actually receive the least for the product. So whether it's actual products like coffee and tea, which are some of the more popular, or even products that are more craft or artisan kind of products, textile products, the effort is to move the product right to the point of distribution or sale and remove some of the steps in between that both take away from the producer and also basically, as I said, because of the market, make the prices that they might get for their products more unstable.
Right. Well, many of the fair trade products that we see in some of the small shops and so on here in Rome are coming from Africa, they're coming from Asia, they're coming from South America. What sort of products are these that we're seeing? You said artisan products, coffee, tea, but what might be some other products?
Well, there'd be chocolate, cocoa, like from Ghana, from Africa. There'd be tea from India, there's honey, there's juices, there's wines. And these prices with these items I just mentioned are pretty comparative. The prices have been coming down a little bit. But where the fair trade products are not comparative would be in jams and jellies. The multinationals still have a
monopoly on
that. Yes.
But I was going to ask you, many people do look at the fair trade products almost as a luxury product, and they say, oh boy, these prices are a little bit out of my range. I mean, is that always the case, though?
Yes and no. Yes, with the jams and jellies, but with the coffees and teas, the prices have become a bit comparative now. So much so that even people like Nestle's and Starbucks coffee are doing maybe 10% of their coffee from the fair trade industry. And we'd like to see that go up.
In these times of global economic crisis, why should I be willing to pay a bit more? Why should I want to pay more?
Well, I think as a commitment to solidarity in the world, particularly those of us who are in the Christian faith tradition with some belief that the other people in the world are, in fact, our sisters and brothers, our decisions about the food we eat, the clothes we wear, all of the things we purchase, we know more and more have an impact on the wider global community. So what we've pointed out is that a lot of times religious communities or families designate some of their family income, even in hard times, for charity. And we could encourage people and encourage organizations to see the little extra they might have to pay for some of these products as part of that portion of their income that they're willing to spend for charity or for other kinds of activities that they might contribute to. So it's a little bit more, but it has implications, I think, not only fair trade, but even the stores and the markets that we purchase other things from. Those decisions are increasingly more significant for producers everywhere.
Now, I know that you are encouraging other religious orders, especially here in Rome, to participate.
We're saying this is an option. Many of our houses have a 5% budget item for charity, and we're suggesting that this is a good option for charity.
Why is it important that these big religious communities participate in a project like this?
It's important that religious communities, religious houses, consider this as a possible option because there are, in many of these houses, large communities, and so there are a lot of large purchases that someone's benefiting from. So if communities are able to redirect even a portion of their purchasing power, their economic power, to support fair trade, it could have a big impact. And hopefully this might become a permanent change for communities in terms of the way they purchase some products. And as Father Paul mentioned, there are food products, but religious communities also have jubilees and special celebrations. And considering getting fair trade craft or art pieces for those kinds of events is another way to support the other part of fair trade products.
And then just to build on that, religious do have economic power. I think we maybe take it for granted. But when you look at our ministries, even looking out into the world, our ministries of schools and parishes and hospitals, these are other opportunities. But that's if the leadership accepts the idea and gives the witness value as well.
So in other words, it's putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Exactly. And we just heard this one diocese in Ireland, I want to make sure I pronounce it right, Arda and Clonmacnoise, just made the decision to become fair trade, the whole diocese. So there you've got parishes and schools. Also, Cadbury Daily Milk, which is...
biggest chocolate producer in Ireland.
In Ireland, and the favorite chocolate bar in Ireland. So it's,
and the U.K.
And the U.K. as well.
All of the U.K.
Yes, yes. And they have decided to go fair trade, particularly with the farmers in Ghana, because the cocoa beans there are some of the best tasting in the world. So it's a good deal all around for them. But it's going to be a tremendous effect for the farmers in Ghana.
So you're saying that actually businesses themselves can get involved in fair trade.
Exactly.
What kind of a difference does this make to the farmer on the ground, the farmer in Africa, the producer in South America?
Well, I think that the press release that came out connected with Cadbury's decision to move to fair trade chocolate, the closing paragraph, if I can share that, it says Cadbury will also be sourcing cocoa from Kwapaku Koku, one of the first cooperative groups to be fair trade certified, with over 40,000 registered cocoa farmers from across Ghana. Although they are currently only selling 3% of their cocoa as fair trade, they have been able to implement community projects like building primary school classrooms, constructing wells, investing in corn mills. Now that Kwapaku Koku will have the opportunity to sell cocoa to Cadbury on fair trade terms, this will increase their fair trade premiums and therefore the range of farmer support and community development programs they can implement. So this kind of guaranteed stable income in a small community has very significant impact for the quality of life for the people there, as related to schools, clinics, wells, you know, just basic necessities that people have.
What does fair trade mean to the big mass producers and the protectionist policies of countries around the world that say, you know, I want to put a limit to all the cocoa that's coming from one country or the rice that's coming or the wheat because I've got my own quotas within my own country? How does fair trade affect all that?
Well, one way of looking at it is, I'll tell this through a story. There was a Franciscan friar in Ireland who organized a group of about 10 people in the business world, in the education world. It was in a town. And they studied the issue of fair trade and saw that there's benefit to it all around. And over a year, they met and they approached the supermarkets saying that we will buy this item if you stock it. And so it became mainstreamed. Now, here in Rome, these shops are on side streets. And it'll take quite a while, I think, to get it mainstreamed at the supermarket. But in Ireland, it happened. And children began encouraging their parents to buy this type of cereal or this type of chocolate bar.
And I've been to the Holy Land where I've met Christian farmers who've formed a cooperative, and the local parish priest in a little town called Taibe convinced in France a whole chain of supermarkets to buy their olive oil as part of this fair trade agreement, and people are buying it.
Interesting, one of the fair trade shops here in Rome is in the parish center of the parish of Transfigurazione in Monteverde Nuova. The parish staff there values this, and so it's right on church property. You go to Mass, and then afterwards, you can get your coffee or tea or chocolate for the week. There are young adults that are running the shop. Some of them have been to Ghana to visit some of these sites.
So it sounds like it's an initiative that even local parishes can adopt.
Exactly.
One last question. Is there any way that fair trade could affect relations between countries on a global level? Is it such a small initiative that it can't really make a difference?
Well, one of the things that I think about in relation to a question like that is that if, in fact, economic markets are more stable for people in countries that we call developing, whether that's a fair term or not, but developing countries where people are struggling to basically feed themselves and take care of their families. One of the effects, I think, that eases some tensions is that I believe that most people really want to stay in their countries of origin and work and live and raise their families. They want to be where their roots are, where their families are, where their cultures are respected and active. And if
so, you're saying that it will affect immigration.
It could affect immigration if people, in fact, as we were reading about these folks in Ghana now who can actually work and have some kind of stable income. Those are implications, I think, for stabilizing economies in the world and reducing some of the tension that the mass movement for immigration or people who basically want to feed themselves and their families, and so they go looking for a better life, like many of our ancestors did as well.
And a very warm thanks there to Dominican Sister Toni Harris and Marist Father Paul Frechet.
That brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.